Good morning. You're listening to KBBI AM 890 Homer. It's the Coffee Table Show. I'm your host, Renee Gross, and here today we have Representative Paul Seaton. Representative, good to have you in person.
Well, thanks, Renee. It's good to be here and talk to you again here. It's a sure nice day here in Homer, and it's great. Sure haven't missed anything as far as the garden goes, though, because it's been obviously a very cold spring.
Right, there you go. And if you want to join the conversation today talking about the legislative session with Representative Paul Seaton, you can call 235-7721 or email questions at info@kbbi.org. And if you're outside the area, you can call 1-800-949-5224. And Representative Seaton, let's get started. What do you think were your biggest accomplishments this legislative session?
Well, just to back up a little bit, the House Majority Coalition formed last year in 2017, and it formed around a guiding principle of solving Alaska's fiscal crisis. And so the Majority Coalition went forward with that. That was two independents, 17 Democrats and three Republicans, and trying to solve this problem. And so we did pass a comprehensive, sustainable fiscal plan last year. Passed that over to the Senate. Unfortunately, the Senate only was interested in one piece of that. That was the permanent fund and how to utilize that, and wasn't willing to consider the oil tax reform. At some point, we might get into it, but right now, the state of Alaska is getting the lowest percentage of oil taxes it has ever gotten in its history. We are at a 4% gross minimum tax, and that's all we're receiving. So I've been in the legislature for 16 years, and when we first came in and Governor Frank Murkowski was there and knew that we had to change things because we had dropped to 6.7% was the gross tax that we were receiving at that time in 2002 and 3. And so now we're about half of that. So there are some real structural changes that need to be made. And like I say, we can go into that later. We also had a component of a broad-based tax that was the fourth lowest income tax in the nation. And if we'd adopted those things or some rendition of those things, we would have solved our fiscal crisis. But we could only work on what both the House and the Senate are willing to address. And so we solved part of the problem. We've probably got 80% of the problem solved, but the other 20% is a $600 million to $700 million hole in our budget that we're still can only take money out of savings and spend, you know, our kids' future savings from. So we've got work to do, but part of that was solved. I guess in this last year, the most significant thing I think we did was we focused on education, and there was a superintendent's conference over in Seward last year, and Senator Machicki, Representative Chenault, and I were all on a panel discussing that, and out of that came the idea that, well, you know, we have this one budget, which is education, that is the only budget in the state that requires early termination notices to employees. That happens in May. And so the idea was, you know, possibly we could do a early appropriation bill, something. And so that's what I did. I sponsored House Bill 287, which was a early appropriation for education. We passed that over out of the House in February. And it took a little while for the Senate to get there. But in the end, we funded education for this year early enough that no pink slips would have to go out. And in the compromise the Senate had proposed, because they really wanted the percent of market value calculation on the permanent fund, they offered, well, we could do forward funding for next year's education plus $30 million, which is, you know, $117 base student allocation equivalent. And so we accepted that. We moved forward. So we accomplished early funding of education this year, no layoffs, no pink slips, as well as the forward funding for next year. And so I think that we have helped for at least a couple years solve the dilemma of terminating all our new teachers early and then having them find jobs other places in that huge problem we have in education if we give people termination notices and then wait for the budget to pass and be in effect in July to try and rehire them. So I think that was our biggest accomplishment.
And you alluded to this, but, you know, it was the first time the legislature voted to use permanent fund earning reserves to pay for the budget. Can you walk us through a little bit more of the history here? Why did the legislature vote to draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve?
Sure. It used to be that oil taxes paid about 80 to 90% of the budget. With the drop in oil prices, that went down to about 30%. So there was no place for that other money to come from. And actually, our earnings on our $60 billion permanent fund is actually generates more money than does oil taxes now. And, of course, I am saying always that we do need to reform the oil taxes because it's not just that the price had fallen. It's also that the system that we have in place generates little revenue. And so tapping that largest asset that we have, we want to make sure that we're not in any way risking the principle of the permanent fund. We can't. The Constitution says that the legislature cannot take anything out of the principle without the vote of the people. But we have fully the ability to take as much as we want out of the earnings reserve, which is about $17 billion of that $60 billion. And so that kind of gets scary when with just a majority vote, you can take that much. So what we did was we passed SB 26 in a radically different form than it had passed either the Senate or the House, and we stripped it down to just limiting the legislature's ability to take more than 5.25% of the market value of the fund out of the earnings reserve. So that's about $2.7 billion at this current year where we are now. And so that filled a big part of the gap. But, you know, when you have a $3.5 billion hole and you fill about 2.7, you're still looking at $600 million or so hole that you have to fill from someplace. So that was what the permanent fund earnings account was able to contribute without getting into what's called ad hoc draws. In other words, just going into the savings account and taking whatever you want from it. And we need to leave a pretty good size in that because that $60 billion is all invested in a very wide, diverse diversity of things, stocks and bonds and real estate and all kinds of issues around the world and around the United States. Any losses that are received all come out of the earnings reserve, not out of the principal. So it can fluctuate quite a bit. I mean, when we had the 10% correction earlier this year in the stock market, it went down $3.3 billion. Basically overnight. So you have to maintain a fairly good sized earnings reserve. Otherwise, you would risk financial hardship for sure.
And you say it fixes part of the fiscal crisis. What do you see to fix the rest of it?
Well, and the House did pass the Comprehensive Sustainable Fiscal Plan, and that went over to the Senate. But the pieces that they weren't willing to touch were any diversification of our revenue. It didn't matter whether it was alcohol tax, whether it was motor fuels tax, whether it was the governor 2 years ago had proposed eight different taxes, I think it was, a small income tax, doubling the motor fuels tax. We're the lowest motor fuels tax in the nation. We don't have any sales tax. He didn't propose that, but that would be a broad-based tax. And Alaska has no property tax either. So we're the only state in the nation that doesn't have some kind of a tax where the general citizenry, pays into the treasury for the services that are provided to the people. So no sales tax, state sales tax, no state property tax, no state income tax. And so that makes it very difficult to have a sustainable budget, because if you're just basing it on things that fluctuate wildly, like the price of oil or the interest on stock investments, then your budget is going to wildly swing. And so that's where we are.
Do you see some of those taxes as on the table for next year?
Well, we know that unless there's a huge rebound in oil prices, then we're going to have to diversify our income somehow. And people talk about diversifying the economy, but it doesn't help to diversify the economy if you don't have any revenue from the economy, which is the state's problem. There's no source of revenue that comes from jobs, whether that's people earning money and spending it and having sales tax like many states do, or an income tax, which is less conflicting with local governments than would be a sales tax. And we have no state property tax on ordinary property. There is a property tax on oil and gas properties, but that's the only property tax that goes to the state.
And let's change gears here a little bit. We were talking about, you know, how the government is funding the budget, but let's talk about, you know, let's start with the operating budget, $5.4 billion in unrestricted state general funds, and about $10 billion when you consider, include federal cash. Can you talk about some of the highlights of the operating budget?
Sure. First of all, people should realize that we have cut the budget by $1 billion or over $1 billion since 2015. So the budget has been coming down. There's approximately 3,000 fewer state employees now than there were in 2015. Last year it was about 2,600. So there's another 400 or so people that have not been retained in state government. So there are cuts that are made there. We're $30 million below what we used to fund for the university. Department of Education is down like $97 million from 2015. And transportation have been cut about $98 million as well. So nearly every program has been reduced, as well as operating budget and personnel, which makes up the largest segment of a budget, is personnel costs to provide those services. And we've gotten to the point now where people are saying, no, the cuts have been too deep, especially like in public safety. People realize, well, you closed the Nanilchik trooper post, you closed Talkeetna, you know, there's no longer a trooper post in Girdwood. I mean, these are just necessary when you cut the budget. How do you maintain? So closing some of those facilities that people really relied on for local police protection has just been one of the consequences. And in Anchorage and Fairbanks are seeing the huge changes with a lower number of troopers and lower number of prosecutors. Prosecutors got cut so much that all of the small crimes they wouldn't even prosecute, because they had to focus on major felonies. And so now we've added some new prosecutors back, five new prosecutors. We've added public defenders, because if you don't have the public defenders, the prosecutors can't have a swift trial, because there's nobody to assign on the other side of the equation in the legal system, and so you can't have that trial. So we've done a number of those things, trying to get back up to it. A lot of people are saying you've got in all regions of the state maintenance on roads too much. It's costing a lot of people, because they're getting more windshield cracks. It's 24 to 48 hours before roads are cleared, not the main road, but all the side roads. So those are issues that people are saying, the lifestyle we want in Alaska needs to be maintained. And so at some point we're going to get back to, okay, how do we increase our revenues to the state? And So we'll see what comes out of the negotiations. So anyway, I would like to say that, you know, public radio saw no cuts this year. We had the $2 million there, as well as public television was the same amount. Civil Air Patrol, we actually increased some. The Civil Air Patrol was had been cut too much. The House restored the museum grants and aid. Museums are a critical piece for all these small communities across the state. And, you know, it's not that much. It's $100,000. But when you divvy it up among the museum, it keeps them in business. And we made sure that the Alaska Performance Scholarship is still there, and that that fund was kept whole. There were attempts to drain money from it and make it insolvent in the future, and we resisted those. And youth cuts, there weren't any, youth courts, there weren't any cuts to those. Some of the things help preserve money, and that's like day habilitation. This allows seniors that are disabled to stay in their own homes better, and so they're not institutionalized, because when you institutionalize somebody in Alaska, it gets very, very expensive in a hurry. And we had $10.5 million of matching grants to support hospital-based mental health care, because we don't have enough mental health facilities in the state. And what has happened is people are going to the emergency room with mental health problems. And so there's been a number of issues we've worked out there. So we could go on beyond that and talk about senior benefits. We had to extend those. Otherwise, that would have sunsetted this year. And the other thing is there's some matching money. It's called Pittman-Robertson money that comes from the federal government. It's a 3-to-1 match, so the government, the federal government pays 75%. But what that is for hunter access, as well as now it can be used for wildlife viewing access. And that comes from a tax that's on not only guns and ammunition, but camping supplies and things. So we put two people in the Department of Fish and Game and one in Department of Natural Resources, because there weren't the personnel to actually oversee those grants. And the problem was that we were turning back money. It would be about $9 million in each of last year and the coming year if we hadn't had some administration of that. But what that does allow, it allows municipalities that want to develop wildlife viewing trails or hunter access to put up the 25% match. And because Fish and Game and DNR still have to oversee and administer the grant, but then the federal and the local effort can get those trails in place. And so we don't have to turn back that, but we don't have to, if local communities have projects that they want to fund, then that's only 25% from them and the 75% from the federal government. So it's a way to extend services to municipalities without the state actually having to cough up the money. Because the way it is, we can only use the Fish and Game funds for hunter access. But if municipalities want to put in the 25% match, then that can be used for wildlife viewing and trails and that kind of thing. So just little details. But, you know, when you're turning back $9 million a year of federal money, we had to do several different pieces of the budget to make sure that all worked. But we're happy to get there. So.
And what about the capital budget? Can you give us some highlights of that?
Sure. The capital budget, of course, is a really important piece. And I think I've got some figures that I can give you. The capital budget, first of all, let me explain, isn't just capital projects. There are other pieces of the budget, supplemental. And just to explain what a supplemental is, supplemental, we're in the fiscal year 2018 right now. And if something is underfunded this year, we can make an appropriation for the FY18 money, not FY19 money, if we have money available. And there's What's built into the budget is called headroom. So when we take money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, we generally have $100 to $200 million that we need there so that there's money in case an emergency comes up. We can tap that money and do it without having to go back into special sessions and start with a new appropriation bill, because everything has to be appropriated by the legislature. So those supplemental items are included in the capital budget. And so anyway, there was a match for the Code Blue safety and the medical, necessities. There's the Alaska Travel Industry got the $3 million full for advertising, making sure that the travel industry still has a pull from people outside. Village Safe Water and infrastructure in villages, that's for sewer and waste and safe water, was $68 million, and Pioneer Home repairs is $1 million. Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund, $3.5 million, and we added $8 million for that Pittman Robertson money for the wildlife. It wasn't the wildlife viewing trail, it was for the hunter access. That is matching the federal funds. Weatherization, we had $6 million in there, and the municipal harbor grants, $5 million. So you go right down there, and get through there, but we have, there's a lot of things in there. The list is long. So sexual assault kit backlogs, there's $2.5 million or $2.75 million to test those. There's like 3,600 rape kits across the state that haven't been tested. And so catching up on that backlog and making sure we do that is important, because when they do that, they find some matches so that you have serial rapists that need to be taken, identified and to prevent further victims from having that as well. So there's grants to neighborhood watch programs. So if there is a neighborhood watch program that wants to start, a small amount, but it's for signage and for those kind of things, vests that people can wear, for when they're walking down the streets and doing those kind of things. The Marine Highway Vessel Funds, we put $20 million in there. That $20 million will enable a good schedule to be funded ahead of time. We were looking at having to return all the tickets because we were going to run out of money this year in the Marine Highway Fund, and they were going to have to cancel all the tickets as of the end of April. And so we got that earlier. And now there's this $20 million, which is in the Marine Highway Fund, which will make sure that the Marine Highway and the ferries serving here in Seldovia and on out the chain, as well as Southeastern, will be able to function on time, and the schedules can be posted, and people can buy tickets with a surety that that will happen. So there's some other things like $12 million for opioid abuse programs. That's over 2 years. So it's basically $6 million a year. So those are some of the things that were there. Like I say, there's a myriad of other things as well. And there were a couple of reappropriations that were, some of the money last year had been moved from Southeast, from the Juneau Access Road to the Northern Lynn Canal transportation projects, which actually included the Juneau Access Road. And that money, some of that got moved back, $21 million into the Juneau Access Fund. I don't think it's going to be spent there, but it's sitting there. And so anyway, that's a little bit of what we're doing.
Is there anything you had wish you had seen in there, or a challenge in the budget?
Well, there was some things that we were hoping to have a little more weatherization money in there. That is a program that has really good returns for what's invested for energy conservation. We have a lot of homes in Alaska that still are, they're not cardboard walls, but they're not really very economically efficient as far as weatherization goes, and that's something we would have had liked to have a bigger, and as well as the harbor matching fund program that we had $5 million in there from the House that got cut. So there's not all the programs across the state. There's only a couple of programs that'll be funded by there. So, and there is $20 million in the Port of Anchorage there to move forward with that project. So it's a big project, so we're not funding most of it, but there is some money there.
And can you talk about what happened to Medicaid funding for this fiscal year?
Sure. It was a really difficult thing that happened last year. Again, we've had problems with the Senate funding the bills that are owed or anticipated to be there. And so it was underfunded about $70 million last year. And when we got the budget this year, that anticipation had gone up to $98 million. And for the first time in years and years, we did a fast-track supplemental because at the 1st of April, there would have been no more payments being made. And so during the session, we took care of some of those immediate items and funded $45 million of payments. These are not paying for services that are required to be delivered by state law and federal law. I mean, if you're receiving Medicaid and somebody's eligible for Medicaid, you have to provide the service. And then that's reimbursed from a 50% match with regular Medicaid from the state funds and 50% from the federal funds. But the problem was the money wasn't there, going to be there after 1st of April to do that. And unfortunately, we only got $45 million in the fast-track supplemental. That was all the Senate would do. And then when we came down here, instead of the $48 million, they wanted to short fund it by $20 million. And so in the end, the negotiations, we had to short fund that. That just rolls the money over to past July 1st. And so it's a hole you're digging in next year's budget. We've tried in the House to be very transparent. I've been the chair of the Finance Committee for the operating budget, and we've tried to take care of these problems. When you can see that you're going to need more money for a project, you should fund it on your budget instead of short funding it and then having to come back next year with a supplemental. So that's been a big push that we've had. So that's been the problem with the Medicaid. And then here at the last, the problem was that the 48 had actually grown in the amount, and unfortunately the department didn't talk to us and tell us that that 48 was actually more than that. So then there's much more underfunding than we thought. We thought there would only be 10 days of delay in payments, which anybody can live with, and now it's like 3 weeks of delay until for July 1st. So.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Homer Representative Paul Seaton. If you want to join the conversation, talk about the legislative session, if you have questions or comments, you can call 907-235-7721 or email your comments or questions to info@kbbi.org. And if you're outside the area, you can call 1-800-949-5224. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the bills that were passed this session and what they could mean for the Homer area.
Sure. And Renee, before we go, let me just say that, you know, if people want to know more information on these budgets, they can just go to my website, akhouse.org, and then /rep_Seaton. And all of that stuff is available there, as well as my newsletters.
You're listening to Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. We're talking today about the legislative session with Representative Paul Seaton. And if you want to join the conversation, call 235-7721 or email info@kbbi.org. The legislature passed bills on a lot of issues that could have a big effect on the Homer area, from addressing crime to banning smoking. So let's walk through some of them. There was a wide-ranging bill to fight crime, HB 312. It does a lot of things, such as make it easier for police to arrest people accused of assaulting medical workers and make those penalties tougher. It gives the Attorney General the ability to restrict new types of illicit drugs. But perhaps most noticeably, it gives judges a bigger ability to hold people in jail who are accused of certain crimes. How will this affect places like Anchor Point, where crime is a big concern?
Well, I do think that crime is a big concern everywhere. Wouldn't want to just pick out Anchor Point. But yeah, one of the problems in the crime bill that we had, or the revision of criminal statutes, was that there's a tool for pretrial. 40% of all of the people that were incarcerated had never been convicted of anything 4 years ago. And so there was a revision of that to say, hey, making people be in prison because they can't pay a bail isn't probably very effective for us, the people of the state, and it really is incarcerating people when they haven't been convicted of anything. So this tool went into effect that said, okay, let's look at not whether people can pay, but how likely they are to not show up for their trial. And that was, you know, a good policy, but it had some holes in it. And one of the holes was that until January of this coming year, it didn't incorporate convictions from out of state. And so you had people that were bad folks from out-of-state convictions that were here, and they would do something that was a low-level crime, and so they would be released into the community. So one of the big fixes was to roll the fixes to the crime bill into 213, which was really, originally the bill was just about protecting people in healthcare facilities, because there was no way in which you could have somebody going kind of nuts in a emergency room, and there wasn't any way you could really do anything about it because it wasn't a crime. And so that was established to make sure that we could control those kind of things, whether it's somebody having a drug overdose problem that is, you know, wasn't passed out, but was just acting terribly wrong. And so that's what that original bill was, but then the whole crime bill got rolled into that. And just so everybody understands, in Alaska, we are saved from the fate of the federal government, where you have all these riders, you have these extraneous bills that have nothing to do with the underlying bill, such as the Patriot Act that was tacked on to Hurricane Katrina. And 20 other bills were in there as well. In the state of Alaska, the Constitution says it has to be one subject. So if you're dealing with crime, you can put a bunch of different crime things in there, but you can't put something in there that doesn't deal with crime. You can't put fish and game in there unless fish and game, you were talking about a criminal action that fish and game was doing. So we're saved some ways in that there's a single subject rule. And at the end of sessions, what happened is you look at that subject and a whole bunch of things get rolled in at one time. So that was the most important part of that, was to change that pretrial portion so that outside convictions can be brought in, even though they're not within the tool now, but the judge can consider them when looking at whether somebody should be released pretrial and whether they have a record of doing numerous bad things from out of state.
Let's take a call from a listener. We've got Greg on line one. Greg, thanks for calling. Tell us about your question or comment.
Yes, thank you, Renee, and thank you, Representative Seaton. Really appreciate your service. And on the news the other day, I just have a question. I heard that the legislature was looking at taking a loan out to pay the oil tax credits, and to me that sounds almost counterintuitive, but I understand the state needs to meet its obligations whatever way we need to meet them. But when we offer credits, it's usually on money we received already, and I just wanted to get your opinion on that and what the status of that provision is. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen on the radio. Really appreciate you. Thank you.
Sure, and thanks for that question. That was a big issue at the towards the end of session. We'd been looking at it for quite a while. And what it is that last year the House passed over to the Senate as part of our comprehensive fiscal plan, House Bill 111, which was an oil tax and oil tax credit rewrite system. The Senate wouldn't consider the oil tax portion of it, but we did take that and reform the oil tax credit system so that no longer are those cashable credits generated at all. But it left about $800 million to potentially about $1 billion of credits that had already been earned, had been satisfied. The people had spent the money on the North Slope where, you know, they got 35% of those as cashable credits. And the way that worked was that if the price was below $15 a barrel, then 15% of what we got from oil tax, oil production tax, went into this fund to pay those credits. And so that had been going on for a while, but it's sure not paying them off very fast. So what House Bill 331 did is said, okay, we can bond for about 3%. And we said, okay, we will make a bond for this, and it's just subject to appropriation. It's not constitutional state debt. But what would happen would be we would take a discount from what was owed on those cashable credits, enough to pay for all the financing of the bonds. So it would give these small oil companies, because you had to be a small oil company to get these cashable credits in the first place, it would give them liquidity again so that they could continue to invest in properties on the North Slope to get oil production up. But it wouldn't cost us money because the discount rate would mean that the financing would be borne by taking less money on those. So I hope that that's clear enough. We went through this, and a lot of us were quite resistant to that. It took a lot of delving into it to make sure that we would have a way in which those tax credits would be, that they could get a slightly less discount rate if they guaranteed to reinvest the money in Alaska in the next 2 years, if they would give an overriding royalty on the project, which is basically saying that they'll pay us 0.2% or something over the next 20 years of all of the production would come to us, the value of that production. And so anyway, those things would still make it so that we would not be costing the state any additional money. We'd be using the state's borrowing capacity, but that could get that off of the books and taken care of so that we would be able to start the small producers back into the production game. So shouldn't cost the state any money. There's a lawsuit challenging those now. I'm happy that that's already been filed, so we can find out if there's a constitutional problem. Then everybody will know sooner rather than later. So anyway, that was the genesis of that, trying to figure out how we get these tax credits paid off at a way in which costs us less money. In the initial years anyway, because it's the interest on the debt that we're paying for the next 3 years and not the other. And then still we'll be paying it less over 10 years per year than we would have if we were trying to pay off the tax credits under the normal scheme.
And we're going to see some other changes this year. Smoking will be banned in offices and bars. The House waited about 2 years to pass legislation on this. What made it finally pass?
Well, there was resistance from especially one member that didn't like to impose regulations, state regulations, mandates on everybody across the state without, because we have a history of local government, local control. And so that representative said that it would only pass out of her committee if there was a local opt-out provision in there. And the Cancer Society and some other groups who were in favor were very resistant for a while of having a local opt-out, even though the chance of any community opting out is infinitesimally small. And so in the end, the supporters came around and said, yeah, you know, we want to have the, it apply statewide, but a municipality, a local government could opt out if they wanted to, but they, I don't think that there's really any chance that that will happen.
And what would it take to opt out?
You'd have to have a vote of the people, and you'd have to pass it that you wanted to allow smoking in the workplace, kind of thing. So that, was there. And in the end, there were a couple of other provisions that were changed, and that was marijuana is controlled in there except if the Marijuana Control Board allows in use, but there'll have to be all these standalone buildings there or whatever. But that would be, you know, ventilation, all these things required, because that's a separate board that would control that. And also e-cigarettes were banned, and vaping, the vape stuff is controlled just like smoke is controlled, as well as there was a bill that Senator Stevens, our senator, put forward, which was Senate Bill 15, which banned e-cigarettes for those under 19, I believe was a year.
And so banning some things, but they also, the legislature passed a bill to allow for a pilot program of industrial hemp production. You said in a previous newsletter that this could mean a big boost for the Kenai Peninsula agricultural community. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Industrial hemp doesn't have any of the, or a so low a level of THC, which is the hallucinogenic portion of cannabis. And hemp is, you know, I mean, the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper. And so hemp is something, you know, we've had rope for hemp, we've had cloth, there's all kinds of industrial uses for hemp. It's a very important product that was much more so earlier in our history. And then it got tied up with marijuana, and all of a sudden, it grows really well in the climates that we have. Could be a very valuable product, and it doesn't require the care that like grains do or those kind of things. And so has some real opportunity for agricultural use here on the Kenai Peninsula as well as in interior Alaska. So there are people that have been very eager and talking about it to us for several years. So I'm happy that we were able to get that there. And of course, if you've got hemp that has too much THC in it, then it's marijuana, and you can't be mixing those things.
And in light of a recent school shooting, I think it might be important to bring up a resolution that the House passed to support school safety. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. That's H.R. 7. And I think that what we're going to, I'm looking at trying to have a town hall meeting or two here in the Homer area. And we need the ideas of people around. I was one of the supporters of HB 75, which was right now, even if you know somebody is mentally unstable or is even hasn't directly threatened someone but is threatening in a way that they probably shouldn't have firearms, you can't really take the firearms away from somebody. And so that bill would have allowed a peace officer, you know, stimulated by a family member probably, to go to the judge and say, here's this evidence, and we think that we should take these firearms out of this home. And the family is wanting to do that as well. And for up to 6 months. But it would be through a judicial process. It wasn't just the police going in and doing it, or it wasn't. Originally, the bill said a family member could go to the judge, and that was eliminated because there are too many domestic conflicts and everything. So it would have to be a peace officer would be having to present the evidence to a judge to say, hey, for on a temporary basis, until this person becomes more stable, we need to remove firearms from the home.
Some people say that that bill didn't pass because of disagreements with the NRA. Would you agree with that assessment?
Probably, yeah. I've been an NRA member for years. In fact, when I was about 20 years old or 18 years old, I might even be 16 down in California, I got my first firearm, which was a M1 carbine. The kind in World War II, the tank operators and kept as their, you know, shorter version. And so I'm very protective of Second Amendment rights, but I'm very concerned that we have to do things that are sensible and reasonable in that area as well. And I think HB 75, the final version, was a reasonable way to approach that problem.
And Representative Seaton, we've just got about 5 minutes left before we go. I would like to ask you about your plans for running this year. Yesterday at a brown bag meeting at the Homer Chamber of Commerce, you said that you were unsure what party you were going to run with. Is that?
Well, a question was asked, and I try to keep the legislative context and legislative reports separate from campaigning, and that'll all start after the 1st of June. And so the question was, am I running? And yes, I filed my letter of intent, and I will be running, and I'll be running in a primary. But I'm not going to, I don't want to mix politics so much into the legislative context here. So, and you know, it'll all be satisfied before June 1st.
Great. Well, Representative Seaton, thank you so much for your time. I'm Renee Gross. You've been listening to The Coffee Table. This is KBBI AM 890 Homer.